My name is Michael McCusker. I guess the Democrats have included God and Jerusalem in their platform statement. I consider that a direct pandering to the Republicans, who always claim that they and only they have God and Jerusalem, I guess. Also, they claim American exceptionalism. And there's an article, because Obama is about to speak tonight at the Democratic Convention, indoors rather than under the stars, or lightning and thunder, as they are feared might occur. It was written a couple of years ago by Jonathan Zimmerman, who teaches history and education at New York University, and he's the author of Small Wonder, The Little Red Schoolhouse in History and Memory. And he says, his headline is Idea of Providential Destiny in Play Against Obama. This ran in the Oregonian back in 2010, and actually was reprinted from the LA Times. Is America exceptional? All countries are different, but does America differ from all of them in a fundamental way? Does it have a special purpose or destiny in the world? That's becoming the battle cry of the Republican Party in its bid to unseat President Obama in 2012, which is now. Sarah Palin, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Mike Huckabee, and other GOP presidential hopefuls have all declared Obama insufficiently attuned to American exceptionalism. America is exceptional, they say, except our own president doesn't appreciate it. His worldview is dramatically different from any president, Republican or Democrat, we've had, charged Huckabee. To deny American exceptionalism is, in essence, to deny the heart and soul of this nation. The charge puts Obama and the Democrats in a difficult spot. According to a recent poll, 2 years ago, 58% of Americans agree with the statement, God has granted America a special role in human history, I beg your pardon. Whether we're exceptional or not, then, most of us believe we are, and it would be political suicide for Obama or anyone else to suggest otherwise. Instead, the president should invoke America's long tradition of left-wing exceptionalism. The great warriors for social justice in our history all insisted that America had a providential destiny. Unlike present-day conservatives, however, they also indicted the nation for abandoning this mission. They used American exceptionalism to critique America's vices, not just to sing its virtues. Consider the abolitionist movement of the 19th century, which routinely invoked the nation's divine purpose and its founding documents to condemn slavery. In the first editorial of his magazine, The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison quoted the Declaration of Independence, quote, assenting to the self-evident truth that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I shall strenuously contend for the immediate enfranchisement of our slave population, Garrison wrote. I will not equivocate, I will not excuse, and I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. He was. So was the great African-American abolitionist Frederick Douglass, whose famous 4th of July address in 1852 cited the same document. The Declaration of Independence is the ring bolt to the chain of your nation's destiny, Douglass intoned. The principles contained in that instrument are saving principles. Stand by those principles. Be true to them on all occasions, in all places, against all foes, at whatever cost. But by enslaving black Americans, the nation contradicted this core doctrine. It also violated the Constitution, Douglass insisted. Interpreted as it ought to be interpreted, the Constitution is a glorious liberty document, Douglass argued. Read its preamble. Consider its purpose. Is slavery among them? True, Douglass admitted. The Constitution did say that those bound to service for a term of years, quote-unquote, would be counted as 3/5 of all other persons. But it made no explicit reference to African-American bondage. If the Constitution were intended to be a slave-holding instrument, Douglass argued, why neither slavery, slave-holding, nor slave can anywhere be found in it? After the Civil War, as the nation industrialized, labor activists would likewise invoke America's providential origins. Even socialists got in on the act, quoting Thomas Jefferson rather than Karl Marx. The Socialist Labor Party of the United States reasserts the inalienable right of all men to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the party's 1896 platform declared. With the founders of the American Republic, we hold that the purpose of government is to secure every citizen in the enjoyment of this right, but no such right can be exercised under a system of inequality. Finally, and most famously, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. would quote the Declaration in his I Have a Dream speech in 1963, calling on America to live out the true meaning of its creed. And that creed, King made clear, was both distinctively American and divinely inspired. But America doesn't have a monopoly on it. The creed is universal, after all. All men, and parentheses, women, because it's not included in this article, are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights. America is exceptional because it is the foremost embodiment of these principles, so it also has a special responsibility to uphold them. That's precisely the kind of exceptionalism that Obama and his party need to reinvigorate right now. To Obama's Republican critics, American exceptionalism is synonymous with American superiority. We're not just different, we're better. He should reply with a full-throated defense of a different kind of exceptionalism, one that underscores America's historic struggle to realize its proclaimed values. That doesn't make us any better than anyone else, but it does give us a special duty to fight injustice wherever we find it, especially in ourselves. And that was an article by Jonathan Zimmerman, American Exceptionalism, Idea of Providential Destiny in Play Against Obama. And I'm reading from an article I tore out of the Sunday Oregonian, December 19th, 2010, and it is reprinted from the Los Angeles Times of that, probably that same month, that same year. Anyway, it's just as appropriate at this moment as it was when it was written, perhaps even more so because he is speaking tonight. Maybe he'll bring up some points of that. This exceptionalism all sounds like the master race philosophy, and I think we've had enough of that in this world, certainly in the last century. Now I'd like to read something by Peter Elderman, who's a professor of law at Georgetown University and the author most recently of So Rich, So Poor, Why It Is So Hard to End Poverty in America. And this is the headline of his article, Poverty in America, Why Can't We End It? And it ran in the New York Times on July 29th this year. Ronald Reagan famously said, "We fought a war on poverty and poverty won." With 46 million Americans, 15% of the population, now counted as poor, it's tempting to think he may have been right. Look a little deeper and the temptation grows. The lowest percentage in poverty since we started counting was 11.1% in 1973. The rate climbed as high as 15.2% in 1983. In 2000, after a spurt of prosperity, it went back down to 11.3%, and yet 15 million more people are poor today. At the same time, we have done a lot that works. From Social Security to food stamps to the Earned Income Tax Credit and on, we have enacted programs that now keep 40 million people out of poverty. Poverty would be nearly double what it is now without these measures, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. To say that poverty won is like saying the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts failed because there is still pollution. With all of that, why have we not achieved more? Four reasons. an astonishing number of people work at low-wage jobs. Plus, many more households are headed now by a single parent, making it difficult for them to earn a living income from the jobs that are typically available. The near disappearance of cash assistance for low-income mothers and children, i.e. welfare, in much of the country plays a contributing role also. And persistent issues of race and gender mean higher poverty among minorities and families headed by single mothers. The first thing needed if we're to get people out of poverty is more jobs that pay decent wages. There aren't enough of these in our current economy. The need for good jobs extends far beyond the current crises. We will need a full employment policy and a bigger investment in 21st century education and skill development strategies if we're to have any hope of breaking out of the current economic malaise. This isn't a problem specific to the current moment. We've been drowning in a flood of low-wage jobs for the last 40 years. Most of the income of people in poverty comes from work. According to the most recent data available from the Census Bureau, 104 million people, a third of the population, have annual incomes below twice the poverty line, less than $38,000 for a family of three. They struggle to make ends meet every month. Half the jobs in the nation pay less than $34,000 a year, according to the Economic Policy Institute. A quarter pay below the poverty line for a family of four, less than $20,000 annually. Families that can send another adult to work to have done better, but single mothers and fathers don't have that option. Poverty among families with children headed by single mothers exceeds 40%. Wages for those who work on jobs in the bottom half have been stuck since 1973, increasing just 7%. It's not just that the whole economy stagnated. There's been growth, a lot of it, but it has stuck at the top. The realization that 99% of us have been left in the dust by the 1% at the top, some much further behind than others, came far later than it should have. Rip Van Winkle and then some. It took the Great Recession to get people's attention, but the facts had been accumulating for a long time. If we've been awakened, we can act. Low-wage jobs bedevil tens of millions of people. At the other end of the low-income spectrum, we have a different problem. The safety net for single mothers and their children has developed a gaping hole over the past dozen years. This is a major cause of the dramatic increase in extreme poverty during those years. The census tells us that 20.5 million people earn incomes below half the poverty line, less than about $9,500 for a family of three, up 8 million from 2000. Why? A substantial reason is the near demise of welfare, now called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. In the mid-90s, more than two-thirds of children in poor families received welfare, but that number has dwindled over the past decade and a half to roughly 27%. One result, 6 million people have no income other than food stamps. Food stamps provide an income at a third of the poverty line, close to $6,300 for a family of three. It's hard to understand how they survive. At least we do have food stamps. They have been a powerful anti-recession tool in the past 5 years, with the number of recipients rising to 46 million people today from 26.3 million in 2007. By contrast, welfare has done little to counter the impact of the recession. Although the number of people receiving cash assistance rose from 3.9 million to 4.5 million over 2007, many states actually reduced the size of their rolls and lowered benefits to those in greatest need. Race and gender play an enormous part in determining poverty's continuing course. Minorities are disproportionately poor. Around 27% of African Americans, Latinos, and American Indians are poor versus 10% of whites. Wealth disparities are even wider. At the same time, whites constitute the largest number among the poor. This is a fact that bears emphasis since measures to raise income and provide work supports will help more whites than minorities. But we cannot ignore race and gender, both because they present particular challenges and because so much of the policies of poverty is grounded in those issues. The politics of poverty, I beg your pardon, is grounded in those issues. We know what we need to do. Make the rich pay their fair share of running the country, raise the minimum wage, provide health care and a decent safety net, and the like. But realistically, the immediate challenge is keeping what we have. Representative Paul Ryan and his ideological peers would slash everything from Social Security to Medicare and on through the list, and would hand out more tax breaks to the people at the top. Robin Hood would turn over in his grave. We should not kid ourselves. It isn't certain that things will stay as good as they are now. The wealth and income of the top 1% grows at the expense of everyone else. Money breeds power, and power breeds more money. It is truly a vicious circle. A surefire politics of change would necessarily involve getting people in the middle, from the 30th to the 70th percentile, to see their own economic self-interest. If they vote in their own self-interest, they'll elect people who are likely to be more aligned with people with lower incomes as well as with them. As long as people in the middle identify more with people on the top than with those on the bottom, we are doomed. The obscene amount of money flowing into the electoral process makes things harder yet. But history shows that people power wins sometimes. That's what happened in the Progressive Era a century ago and in the Great Depression as well. The gross inequality of those times produced an amalgam of popular unrest, organization, muckraking journalism, and political leadership that attracted the big and worsening structural problem of economic inequality. The civil rights movement changed the course of history and spread into the women's movement, the environmental movement, and later the gay rights movement. Could we have said on the day before the dawn of each that it would happen, let alone succeed? Did Rosa Parks know? We have the ingredients. For one thing, the demographics of the electorate are changing. The consequences of that are hardly automatic, but they create an opportunity. The new generation of young people, unusually distrustful of encrusted power in all institutions, and as a consequence, tending toward libertarianism, is ripe for a new politics of honesty. Lower income people will participate if there are candidates who speak to their situations. The change has to come from the bottom up and from synergistic leadership that draws it out. When people decide they have had enough and there are candidates who stand for what they want, they will vote accordingly. I have seen days of promise and days of darkness, and I've seen them more than once. All history is like that. The people have the power if they will use it, but they have to see that it is in their interest to do so. And that is Poverty in America, Why Can't We End It? By Peter Edelman, professor of law at Georgetown and author of So Rich, So Poor, Why Is It So Hard to End Poverty in America? And it appeared in the New York Times, Sunday, July 29th, 2012. Well, I'd like to read something that I wrote, and I'm sure if you've listened to this program, you've probably heard it before around this time of year, although I don't do it every year. But it's about a friend of mine who was killed in Vietnam 46 years ago, tomorrow, September 7th, 1966. And I've been going over and thinking about all the friends of mine who have died recently. A friend of mine, Arlene, said to me earlier this morning, as we were talking about something like that, she said, that is the index of our lives now, us older people. The index of our lives, I like that term. But sometimes I think back on somebody who's been gone a long, long time. And so I'd like to read this, and it is my opinion only in the entire cosmos and parallel universes, I suppose. Pierce in Thorns. The tall guy's name was Pierce. He looked like Robert Mitchum and wore gloves like an old-time gunfighter when he took his rifle to work with him, which was every day, including weekends. He was Italian, called himself a Guinea, or Guinea, though you wouldn't know it by his name, from Rhode Island, Pawtucket, actually. Because he was a great unstructured cynic, he had tattooed on his back a 12-inch face of Christ in thorns. It was in three colors, red, blue, and green, and covered most of his back. He was drunk when it was needled. It took 7 hours, and he passed out 4 times before walking away with the new scab as sober as God. After he was dead, a chaplain was shocked at the tattoo. He damn near levitated when I turned Pierce's body backside up and asked why. He thought Jesus was a joke, I said. A month before, a sniper shot in between the shoulder blades. Pierce charged Viet Cong trenches on a day of pure misery for us. They had us cold in the murky paddies in front of a village in the middle of a pineapple forest one leaky August afternoon. Pierce instantly went after the local patriots who were mangling foreign devils into bloody shreds with machine guns and mortars, shouting as he charged, "Batman!" He made headlong dashes at the guerrillas, his shouts of "Batman!" heard over everything else. The homeboys frantically tried to blow him away, throwing everything at him but their gold teeth, then abandoned their trenches when he was still on his feet and coming straight at them, screaming, "Batman!" And that was Ron Pierce, unhit and unrestrained that busy day. He died a month later on a day of no consequence when a local shooter put a bullet in his back just above Jesus' crown of thorns and blew out his lungs and heart. A single shot crackling through the torpid September afternoon, as daily a sound as the snorting ugly black pigs, the scrawny squawking chickens, barking dogs too young or mangy for the cooking pot, laughing and shrieking wide-eyed pot-bellied kids wearing T-shirts that never quite covered their genitals. As ordinary a sound as the screams and whimpering of the dead and dying in thousands of villages, in a war that seemed never to end. The big man with the face of Christ on his back and bluebirds flying across his pecs fell like a tree reluctantly crashing to a forest floor. The rest of us were instantly outraged and trashed the village. I ran towards a half-bombed church from which the sniper had fired, and where a few moments before, in the dead quiet of early afternoon, a priest stood smiling and bobbing his bald head as we passed. The priest became a sacrifice for Pierce, his small, thin body churning in his robes toward the altar and back door. I was raising my rifle to cut him down when a blast so close to my ear it almost blew it off my head tumbled the tiny man into the makeshift altar beneath a palm-hewn cross. We burned 2 villages that day in our grieving madness and killed everything too slow to escape our rifles. The smell of flesh and smoke scorched the sky when trucks rumbled down a muddy road to pull us out of the field. Pierce's large dead body was wrapped in a poncho and shoved into a helicopter that barely got off the ground. The pilot fought a strong wind blowing off the South China Sea and just avoided collision with tall trees by whipping the bird on its side and flitting between skinny, stalked palms. He flew back over us and dipped the chopper as if in salute to say, "Your friend's okay. I'm taking him home." Behind us, in 2 smoldering villages, lay the slaughtered revenge for the death of our friend. An irreverent, lusty, and laughing adventurer who, after all, did little more than shoot a rifle or throw a grenade, except, being a modern man, he was also able to push the buttons of Western civilization, turn the key to the ignition of the Porsche he had saved his combat pay to buy, flick electric switches and deadbolt locked lathe and plaster architrosities mass-produced on the great plains our ancestors plowed up and exterminated the Indians to build. My very good friend and badass mentor, Ronald Pierce, died in a war in which he was an exceptional and instinctual warrior. Not a killer, though. His talent for combat forced him to kill. Swift, merciless vengeance for his death obliterated diminutive Asian home folk, smaller and crunched in their deaths, who lay inside or in front of mud huts that didn't have televisions or macadam driveways for Porsches. The cow paths that led from their impoverished villages out to the open paddies were not cluttered with the ugly urban junkyards of modern USA. I regret I did not have the presence of mind or temerity to skin Pierce and preserve his tattoo of Christ in thorns. I think he might have expected me to. I wish I had saved it from the maggots, tanned and framed it for my wall where it might hang alongside a painting of my skull shining in ocean depths, which was painted by another Vietnam veteran, also ex-USMC, who thought a journey across the big pond several years ago would be my last, an attempt to imitate Somerset Maugham, and gave it to me when I returned. And sort of as a P.S., I met Pierce's cousin in D.C. while the Vietnam Memorial was dedicated on Veterans Day, which used to be Armistice Day, in 1982, which is now 30 years ago. We were in a hotel ballroom with hundreds of other Marines who attended the ceremony, and it was quite by accident that we ran across each other. Like I said, he'd served in another company in the same battalion. And the fellow who painted me my skull shining on the bottom of the ocean lives upstairs from me these days. His name is William Michael Schuster. Some of you might know him. Well, pardon me for the dead air. I'm looking for something that I thought I had brought, and I didn't. This is the second time, less than a month. So I'd like to read Facts, 360 BC to AD 2012, In Memoriam, After Years of Health Problems, Facts Has Finally Died, by Rex W. Hupke, Chicago Tribune reporter. A quick review of the long and illustrious career of Facts reveals some of the world's most cherished absolutes. Gravity makes things fall down, 2 plus 2 equals 4, the sky is blue. But for many, Facts' most memorable moments came in simple day-to-day realities, from a child's certainty of its mother's love to the comforting knowledge that a favorite television show would start promptly at 8 p.m. Over the centuries, Facts became such a prevalent part of most people's lives that Irish philosopher Edmund Burke once said, Facts are to the mind what food is to the body. To the shock of most sentient beings, Facts died Wednesday, April 18th, 2012, after a long battle for relevancy with the 24-hour news cycle, blogs, and the Internet. Though few expected Facts to pull out of its years-long downward spiral, the official cause of death was from injuries suffered when Florida Republican Representative Alan West steadfastly declared that as many as 81 of his fellow members of the U.S. House of Representatives are communists. And he did that this last April. Facts held on for several years, for several days after that assault, brought on without a scrap of evidence or reason, before expiring peacefully at its home in a high school physics book. Facts was 2,372. It's very depressing, said Mary Poovey, a professor of English at New York University and author of A History of the Modern Fact. I think the thing Americans ought to miss most about facts is the lack of agreement that there are facts. This means we will never reach consensus about anything. Tax policies, presidential candidates, will never agree on anything. Facts was born in ancient Greece, the brainchild of famed philosopher Aristotle. Poovey said that in its youth, Facts was viewed as universal principles that everyone agrees on or shared assumptions. But in the late 16th century, English philosopher and scientist Sir Francis Bacon took Facts under his wing and began to develop a new way of thinking. There was a shift of the word fact to refer to empirical observations, Poovey said. Facts became concrete observations based on evidence. It was growing up. Through the 19th and 20th centuries, facts reached adulthood as the world underwent a shift toward proving things true through the principles of physics and mathematical modeling. There was respect for scientists as arbiters of truth, and facts itself reached the peak of its power. But those halcyon days would not last. Facts is survived by two brothers, rumor and innuendo, and a sister, emphatic assertion. Services are alleged to be private. In lieu of flowers, the family requests that mourners make a donation to their favorite super PAC. And that was from the Chicago Tribune by Rex W. Hupke. And this has been Michael McCusker. I suppose I'll be here next Thursday, I hope with all the copy I intended to bring. If, of course, the sky doesn't fall, or I plunge into the river, or one of those drones comes out of the sky and makes me just a blob in the crosswalk. Next up, NPR News headlines on KMUN and KTCB, Astoria and Killamuck, 91.9 FM and 89.5 FM, Coast Community Radio, and Radio Free Columbia Pacific.